Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, new revelations about the police and EMS response to Eric Garner, who wound up dead in their hands on a Staten Island street. Also, the new taxi and limousine commissioner, Meera Joshi. Is a deal close to allow the pink mustachioed taxi fleet known as Lyft to begin operating in New York? The head of Lyft said yes on this show. We may hear something different today. And have you put old clothing in one of those fake charity clothing drops? Yes, many of them are fake. But first, what should the U.S. do about the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 and the still-escalating war between Israel and Hamas, which had its deadliest day yesterday with 100 Palestinians and 13 Israeli soldiers reported killed? Those of you listening to the BBC just heard a Europe-based report. We're going to get a Washington view with New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger, author of Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
And first on Gaza, there was this Kerry moment over the weekend. He was caught on tape accidentally between tapings for Sunday talk shows, criticizing the extent of the Israeli operation to destroy the Hamas weapons smuggling tunnels. Here it is, as he refers to the Israeli response.
It's a hell of a pinpoint operation. It's a hell of a pinpoint operation.
Right. It's escalating significantly, and it just underscores the need for ceasefire.
We've got to get over there. Yep. Thank you, John. I think, John, we ought to go tonight. I think it's crazy to be sitting around.
Kerry caught being spontaneous. And David Sanger, who is he talking there to? Who is that guy named John on the other end of the phone? Do we know?
You know, I'm not certain. I know a fair number of members of his staff, but I'm not sure who that one was. But the sentiment that you heard in that was certainly a sentiment that we have heard pretty broadly from Secretary Kerry and other members of the administration. I was with Secretary Kerry in Vienna at the Iran nuclear talks just prior to the shootdown, and you know it was clear at that moment that the Israelis appeared to be ready to go into Gaza, and I think the U.S. was most likely advising them, you know, against a ground invasion. But at the same time, you heard the conflict that came from the fact that with the missiles falling on Tel Aviv and elsewhere in Israel, you know, no country would have put up with that, as Secretary Kerry said publicly several times. The question is, how do you do a proportional response that limits the civilian casualties
and still gets the job done?
And, and it's a very difficult thing to do in a very crowded area.
And so that was Kerry being caught spontaneous. Here is Kerry officially on the record on one of those Sunday shows that he made the rounds of yesterday, Fox News Sunday. Listen.
Okay.
Hamas has to understand, you can't just sit there and claim a moral rectitude or the higher ground while you're busy rocketing people and capturing people and digging tunnels to attack them. And this has to stop.
So do those two statements together really kind of reflect what the Obama administration position is? And if it is a position that acknowledges that complexity and the way you were just describing it before, is the U.S. actually telling somebody to do something on one side or the other?
Well, by going to Cairo today and trying to get both sides to sign up to the ceasefire, that's sort of their attempt at an even-handed response. Now, you'll remember there was a ceasefire declaration a Monday ago, and that in the end didn't work. Israel abided by it, and of course Hamas did not. Now, Hamas argued that the Israelis were using that time to prepare for a ground invasion, and whether they were using the time or not, certainly a ground invasion followed.
How can Egypt or the United States or anybody else broker a cessation of hostilities if both sides would rather fight than back down on their demands, which seems to be the case?
Brian, it's always the case in these kind of instances that both sides need to see an advantage in a ceasefire before they're going to agree to one that's lasting. If Israel agrees to one, it may well be either because they come to the conclusion that they have cleared out enough of the tunnels and made their point for a while, or that they believe that Hamas would violate it, and then, you know, that would give them some more of the moral high ground that you heard the secretary refer to. But the fact of the matter remains that Israel's biggest problem right now is that they don't have an easy way to emerge from this with an assurance that Hamas won't simply rearm, that those tunnels won't be filled up again.
Are they tunnels to Egypt?
I'm sorry?
Are the tunnels to Egypt?
Well, the tunnels that they're most worried about right now are infiltration tunnels that go from Gaza into Israel, similar to the one where they stopped a group of commandos who were coming in near an Israeli kibbutz near the Gaza border. There are also tunnels to Egypt, and the Egyptians have done a relatively good job at working at those at their end.
Because those were tunnels through which arms were coming in.
That's right. We're talking about two different kinds of tunnels here, bro. One type is a type that Hamas is using to do infiltration into Israel by basically burrowing under the Gaza-Israeli border, you know, under the checkpoints.
Right.
Very similar to the kind of tunnels in that regard that the Viet Cong used to come up in the middle of American troops during the Vietnam War, or that the North Koreans have used as infiltration tunnels into the south. And then the second kind of tunnels are the ones that are being used to bring in arms from Egypt, or simply to store the rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what they're trying to get at, because they feel that they need to get at this supply if they're going to cut off the rocketing into Israel.
Before we move on to Ukraine, I think we should acknowledge, and you know, you can give us some context on this, that Israel must feel extremely threatened by these rockets and something new about these rockets to go to this extent, and the loss of 13 Israeli soldiers yesterday alone. Israel does not put its soldiers at risk lightly, and you know, Hamas and the Arab world and a lot of people may think that Israel is too belligerent, too militaristic for the way they'll bomb without putting their soldiers at risk. In this case, they are doing a ground invasion that puts their soldiers at risk. They are being killed. And that is very rare for Israel, isn't it?
It is. It is. And they've already lost 13 or so. Of course, those casualties are relatively low when compared to the numbers of Palestinians who have been killed in the attacks as
Correct.
Well.
Mostly civilians.
Now, in the rocketing, I mean, I think you're making a very good point. They feel that there is no way to solve this problem except doing a ground invasion, because the rockets that Hamas has been using, many of which seem to be supplied by Iran and others, are tucked away in these tunnels. There's basically no way to do this from the air. And you can also argue that doing it from the air will obviously risk even greater civilian casualties on the part of the Palestinians, because these are in such crowded areas. But the Israelis, I think, have been very reluctant to do this. And they're reluctant to do it in part because it's not clear how they pull back out without occupying the area, which is ultimately going to lead to more casualties on their part. There may be ways to pull out without occupying, but it may not be a permanent solution to the problem. And they don't want to be in the position here of having to go back in every couple of years and redo what they've just done.
New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger with us. He's also author of the book Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, which brings us to Ukraine, where the situation seems to remain both tragic and outrageous 4 days after the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, with rebels not necessarily cooperating with even trying to get the bodies returned to their families. The Sunday talk shows, David, and again, we're staying on the Washington angle here after hearing the BBC report from over there, seem to be largely about whether the U.S. and Europe are being tough enough on Vladimir Putin. Here is Senator Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press saying President Obama's statement about Putin's involvement was too weak.
One, he didn't call Putin the thug that he is. He didn't call for arming the Ukraine so they can defend themselves against rebel separatists supported by Russia. All of the enemies of our nation are being well supplied. Russia and Iran are helping Syria. 160,000 Syrians have been slaughtered, John Kerry, by Russian-supplied weapons to Assad. Syria is becoming a safe haven for terrorists to attack our nation. How about sanctions that would hit Putin as an individual, their energy sector, their banking sector? The Europeans are never going to lead on this issue. It's indispensable that America lead, and there's a battle of wills between the KGB colonel and the community organizer, and the colonel is winning.
The colonel, Putin, the community organizer, Obama, 48 seconds of Senator Graham on Meet the Press, but here is Kerry moments later pushing back against the call to just label Putin a thug.
David, you know, you can get into these grand sort of proclamations about where things are and where they aren't. The fact is, we live in an extremely complicated world right now where everybody is working on 10 different things simultaneously. Russia is working with us in a cooperative way on the P5 plus one. We just had important meetings in Vienna.
This is about Iran's nuclear program.
In order to try to deal with Iran's nuclear program, Russia was constructive and helpful and worked at that effort. Russia has been constructive in helping to remove 100% of the declared chemical weapons from Syria. In fact, that was an agreement we made months ago, and it never faltered even during these moments of conflict. So this is more complicated than just throwing names at each other and making declarations.
So John Kerry with David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press, New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger with us now. David, that was probably the most surprising clip to me of the various Sunday shows that I watched yesterday, was Kerry actually taking the time to list the things on which Russia is cooperating with us.
Well, it's an accurate list. And the degrees of cooperation vary. I mean, I would say that the Russians were very cooperative at the beginning of the time on Iran and have been less so in recent weeks. But if you take his point out here, it's that there are areas of commonality of interest, and there are areas where clearly we have completely divergent interests. And for a while, you were able to maintain a balance of those two. And then since President Putin retook the presidency, that's become harder and harder to do. And I think Senator Graham's point was that the hardest action should have come right after the Crimea declaration and the reabsorption of Crimea into Russia. But the fact of the matter is that if Senator Graham has got a big complaint here, I suspect in his heart of hearts it's more with the Europeans than it is with President Obama. President Obama has been out ahead on the sanctions of his European allies. And if you get too far out ahead on sanctions, we've seen what happens, which is that the American sanctions are useless and they're routed around by everybody else. Why did Iran work as a sanctions target? Because there was patient diplomacy across two administrations, Bush and Obama, that worked on making sure that the Europeans and others were all enforcing the same sanctions at the same time. If not, you simply go to European banks to get around the American banking sanctions, or you go to European oil traders to get around the American oil sanctions. So, you know, it's easy to stand up and call somebody a thug, and, you know, I have very little doubt here that there are several dictators around who deserve that. But other than making you feel good, I'm not quite sure what that does. So, you know, if there's anything good to come of this awful tragedy of the Malaysian Flight 17, it may be that it gets the Europeans enough of a wake-up call that they and the U.S. get on the same page on sanctions. But it's very possible that even that won't happen.
And
because we've seen the Netherlands do that, and they have the most victims on the plane.
I was just going to ask you about the Netherlands. That plane, of course, originated in Amsterdam, and therefore they had the most victims on the plane. And yet the analysis that I've been hearing over the weekend is that even the Netherlands won't reach the point that the United States is at, even with this debate over whether the United States is being tough enough. Because so much of Europe is so dependent on Russian oil, does it just come down to that, you know, get down on your knees and be nice to them because of energy dependence, no matter what they do to your airplanes or anything else?
You know, I think what that tells you is you need a short-term and long-term strategy to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian oil. And that's where the effort should go. And right now there are bans, of course, on U.S. exports, and there are some good reasons and some not-so-good reasons for that. But if, in fact, you are going to get the Europeans to enforce these sanctions, it's going to have to be because you come up with a way to wean them from the oil. Mm. How did it work that we got everybody aboard on the Iran sanctions? How did the U.S. government manage to go do that? By finding alternative supplies for the Chinese and for others. Russia was part of that solution. Saudi Arabia was another part of that solution. You're not going to solve the European dependency on Russia until you come up with some creative alternatives so that they don't have a cold winter.
Windmills. The Netherlands has lots of windmills, right? I'm just kidding.
Lots of windmills, but that's a little hard to drive your car on that, right?
I guess so. Listeners, what should the United States do in response to the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for New York Times National Security Correspondent David Sanger. And David, I do want to acknowledge that the Washington Post editorial page also called for Obama to at least speak tougher as well as deal tougher with Putin. So it's not just the Lindsey Graham, John McCain axis.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can make a perfectly reasonable argument, and I think I would agree with this, that the administration probably should have been doing that earlier in, you know, the second term after Putin came along. But you do have to stop yourself at some point and say, fine, sounding tough is important. Symbolically, it's important. But in the end, do you want to feel good or do you want to be effective?
Yeah. And listeners, we're going to be joined in a minute, in addition to David Sanger, by Max Seddon from BuzzFeed on the ground in Ukraine. So if there's a question that you want to ask somebody who is actually there on the scene in Ukraine, you'll have a rare opportunity to call into somebody who's there and ask your own question. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In larger context, David, you have written a book about the Obama foreign policy and the Obama doctrine in general. As a non-interventionist in big conflicts, which is where I think his starting point usually is, how do you see Obama's reaction to Ukraine and Gaza as consistent with or departing from his surprising use of American power, as your book title has it?
Sure. So the Obama doctrine in the first term was to make use as much as possible of light footprint strategies. Think the drone attacks in Pakistan, which rose sixfold over the number in the Bush case, in the Bush administration, the cyber attacks on the Iranian nuclear program, the use of special forces, not only to get bin Laden, but in other places. These were all examples of using forces in a way where the United States could do a pinpoint strike, but not stay around to occupy a country. It's occupation that created us so many troubles in Afghanistan and in Iraq. In the second term, I think it's fair to say that the light footprint strategy is pretty well run out of gas. Drones, cyber, special forces aren't terribly useful in the Syrian conflict, where 150,000 have died. Doesn't help you very much in a case like Crimea, where clearly the Russian origin population wanted to go back and be part of Russia. So no one was going to go intervene there. I think you could argue that his indecision about supporting the Syrian rebels may have provided some inspiration to others around the world, maybe even the Chinese in their islands disputes, in sort of saying, you know, the United States is not willing to go an extra mile to defend this piece of territory or that piece of territory. And that's because the president has defined American national interest pretty clearly, but also pretty narrowly, that something's got to be a direct threat to the U.S. And a lot of the territory, including the Syrian case, didn't look like that until now that ISIS is creating enough of a no man's land out there that you could imagine a situation where it could be ripe for Al Qaeda or others to try to plan a sort of 9/11 too.
and on direct threat to the United States with respect to Russia and Ukraine, some of the biggest hawks in the U.S. are saying this is nothing but a proxy war by Putin against the United States. It may look like a local conflict to us that has to do with Russian populations in Ukraine wanting to more identify with Russia or split away from the government of Ukraine, or Russia wanting to have regional influence over Ukraine, plain and simple. But there are those in the United States, and some of them were on the Sunday talk shows yesterday, saying that this whole thing with Putin arming the rebels over there is a proxy war by Putin ultimately against the United States. Do you see any truth to that?
You know, I think you've got to differentiate between a proxy war and an effort to regain influence. Okay? There is no overall war, fortunately, between the United States and Russia. And considering they're both nuclear-armed powers, that's a really, really good thing. Putin is driven by the concept that the breakup of the Soviet Union after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was, in his words, you know, the greatest historical catastrophe of the 20th century. Now, we might all disagree, but that's what he thinks. And so what you see him trying to do is around the edges, just in those places where there are Russian enclaves where he feels like he can do so and push it, he's pushing back against NATO expansion. But, you know, is Russia a long-term threat to the United States? Well, certainly with a nuclear arsenal, it could be. But you also remember that they have an economy that's in significant stagnation, that's highly reliant on one export. They have a population that is not growing and not very healthy. Doesn't have the feel of a superpower in the way that we've thought of it before.
John in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with David Sanger, national security correspondent for The Times. Hi, John.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what the recent allegations against spying in Germany and the expulsion of the CIA station chief there, what the implications for that are in regards to a unified front against Russia with the downing of the Malaysian plane?
That's a really interesting question, because Angela Merkel and Germany in general have also been singled out as, you know, a major European power that's not being as strong on Russia as even the U.S. would like them to be.
It's a superb question. So what's interesting is that it hasn't affected the German unity on the Iran talks, right? And Germany was a significant importer of Iranian oil. I think in part because they've given up the Iranian oil, they feel even more vulnerable in the case of their purchases from Russia. But the spy case, the initial spy case, which was the tapping of Angela Merkel's phone, and then this follow-on case in recent weeks in which somebody was arrested, believed to be spying for Russia, and he said, no, actually, I was diverting my material to the CIA.
Huh.
Those have done huge damage to public opinion about the United States in Germany. And I've been in Germany a couple of times in the past few months, and it's extraordinarily evident to everybody.
The first of those was an Edward Snowden revelation, right?
The first was a Snowden revelation, and the second was an arrest of a suspected Russian, somebody who made some motions toward Russia to sell them some materials, and when they picked him up, you know, what did they discover? So my view is that certainly it has created a public suspicion of the United States that is making it much, much harder to build a common ground around an American position.
Also joining us now is BuzzFeed foreign affairs correspondent Max Seddon, who is on the ground in Ukraine. Max, thank you for joining us from there today. Hello from New York.
Thanks, Brian.
And you're also on with New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. Let's see if your line holds up to do this interview. Max, where are you exactly, and what's it like there?
I'm in Donetsk, which is the provincial capital in eastern Ukraine and rebel stronghold where these so-called rebels have barricaded themselves in the last couple weeks. It's about 50 miles west of the Malaysian Airlines crash site, and this morning, it reminded us all of the real problem surrounding what's going to happen with the plane and the investigation, which is it is an active conflict zone. Fighting resumed this morning in northern northwest Donetsk around the train station. There was a lot of shelling. I saw some shell casing. There was an apartment building that caught fire, another one that had pretty much all the windows, and this is about a 15-story building smashed by shelling. There are reports of at least three civilians who have been caught in it. The Ukrainian government has issued conflicting statements about whether their forces are attacking the city, which would be pretty extraordinary in the middle of a removal operation, or whether it is one of the volunteer battalions.
Max, your line is breaking up, so I'm going to repeat some of that for our listeners and see if I understand you correctly, because that would be a new development to me, and maybe a major new development, that even as the complex operation, sometimes being impeded by the rebels, of removing the bodies from the crash site is taking place, the government of Ukraine is launching a new military offensive against the rebels in that area. Is that what you were just saying?
Well, it's not clear. The president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, issued an order today not to engage in any combat operations made to 5 mile radius of the crash site. And the other side at risk. And the Ukraine Security Council denied that they had launched an attack, which is what the rebels claimed. But then a spokesman for a different branch of the armed forces claimed that it was a planned operation. It's very chaotic. It's still not 100% clear what's going on, but it sounds as if one of the Ukrainian volunteer battalions took it upon themselves to do this. And the reason this is so problematic is because it is happening in an area around the train station that specifically holds up the cleanup operation investigation. 251 of the 298 bodies from the plane are currently 10 miles south of the crash site at this train station in this place called Torez, and they are in cold storage in these refrigerated wagons that are supposed to go north to a Ukrainian-controlled city called Kharkiv, where they will eventually be returned to the families. And the problem is for them to get there, they have to go to Donetsk, where there is currently heavy fighting at the train station. Meanwhile, most of the experts who have arrived in Ukraine from the Netherlands and Malaysia and the United Kingdom and other countries are still trying to make their way through Kharkiv to Donetsk. And the fighting in Donetsk and also north of Donetsk on the roads to Kharkiv is obviously complicating that. So only a few of them have arrived so far.
What a mess. And your last article on BuzzFeed was headlined, Bodies from Malaysia Airlines Crash Left in Deserted Train Station. And here is Secretary of State John Kerry on Meet the Press yesterday lashing out at rebel treatment of the remains.
Here's what's currently bothering everybody. Drunken separatists have been piling bodies into trucks and removing them from the site. We only had 75 minutes of access to the site on Friday, 3 hours of access yesterday, despite Mr. Putin and Russia saying they were going to make every effort to make sure there'd be a full and fair investigation, thorough, and the site would be protected.
That was Kerry on Face the Nation, to be precise, and give CBS their due. But Max said in Ukraine, why would rebels mistreat the remains? What would motivate that?
I don't think there's been any attempt to mistreat the remains of the bodies on the signs of the rebels. I think as days go on, the rebels have realized more and more that the worse that this shambolic cleanup goes, it's only going to look bad for them, and it's going to give Kiev more of an international carte blanche to come in and wipe them out the minute the bodies and investigators have left the zone of conflict operations. The issue is just more that it's exposed the false notion that the Donetsk People's Republic and its sister Lugansk People's Republic are really states. They are not. They are loose confederations of armed guys, some of whom have come from Russia, a lot of whom are locals. Ukraine's government has estimated there are between 1,500 and 2,500 different armed groups operating in Donetsk province alone, with membership ranging from 2 people to 200, and the number of these groups changes multiple times every day. When I was there on Saturday, the place was being guarded by these guys from what they were calling prosecutor's office of the Donetsk Republic. Most of them were drunk. One of them was wearing a beekeeping suit. None of them could actually name the prosecutor. And it was just a chaotic mess. Then yesterday, when I saw the monitors in the OSCE being shown, some of these are being all in Ukraine, they were accompanied by former Ukrainian forces who went over to the rebel side, who were highly trained, highly professional, very well equipped. And the problem is that there's only so much of that to go around. And so the minute that the OSCE drove off, the rebel escort went with them, and there was literally no one left to guard the bodies. It was just me, two other reporters, and a bunch of old people milling around this train station, almost none of whom had any idea these bodies were there. Some of them were buying tickets. Some of them were waiting for a bus. Some of them were sitting in this rundown little cafe. And when you don't have any kind of real state apparatus that is able to do any of this in a country that is already pretty dysfunctional, the best of times, Ukraine, you are really inevitably going to have something like this. There are people from the Ukrainian local branches of the Ukrainian Emergency Ministry who are the ones who have actually been taking the bodies. And the Dutch forensic investigators who came today said that considering the circumstances and how unprepared they are for something like this and how few of them there are, they were impressed. These guys are doing the best they can.
Let me not
going to be enough.
And I'm understanding what you're saying about the chaotic situation, lack of responsible people in charge. Individual rebels are going to do what they do in some cases in a situation like that. And I'm going to take one more phone call before we wrap this up for both you and David Sanger on another central question. And it's Rosdy in Newark. Rosdy, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, my question is simply, okay, we know for sure that the missile that is planned out and was something that wasn't a mistake, was prepared for sure. So what was the Russians or separatists' interest to take this plane down? I mean, that doesn't make sense at all.
Well, I think the conventional wisdom here is that it was a mistake, and they thought they were shooting at a Ukrainian military aircraft. And Max said it in Ukraine. Do you have any clues from your reporting if Putin's government supplied the rebels with the kind of surface-to-air missile that brought down the plane? Or I think even more serious, if Russian special forces were in the area or in any way involved with approving the missile shot that took down the plane, even if it was mistaken identity?
Well, the problem is that from day one in eastern Ukraine and going back to Crimea as well, Russia has operated under this very thin film of deniability. So while the Ukrainian United States have been presenting what is a mounting body of increasingly strong evidence that it was rebels, possibly Russian help who shot it down, there isn't really a way that you can say for sure Russia has made this. The site is a mess in a way of such that you if there is smoking, then
it's going to be hard to do a forensics investigation of evidence on the ground. So, David Sanger, last question to you as the same question, because some of this how tough to be on Putin rhetoric has to do with escalating levels of how much Putin was actually involved, how much the Russian government was actually involved with these rebels and these incidents. The highest level of culpability apparently being if Russian special forces were in the area or were in any way involved with approving the missile shot.
That's right. There's sort of three levels going on here, four. One is general support to the rebels. Second is specifically supplying them with these arms. And to my mind, the video that really jumped out was the one of that truck with the one missing missile and three still aboard heading back across into the Russian across the Russian border that you saw within a day of the shootdown. And it's important to have that truck because the radar signature on the radar of that truck could be matched up with the radar signature that was picked up from the missile. The third question is the one you raise. Could there have been Russians right there at the time, not just training, but sort of helping them with the specific shot? And, yeah, I think the conventional wisdom is exactly as you described, Brian, which is they were going after what they thought was a high-flying transport plane or fighter belonging to the Ukrainians. You know, the circumstantial evidence is that they bragged about shooting down a Ukrainian military plane and then pulled that off of social media as soon as it became evident that this had been a commercial plane. That is not court of law proof, but it sure is suspicious, isn't it?
New York Times chief, National Security Correspondent David Sanger, also the author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, and Max Seddon, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for BuzzFeed, on the ground in Ukraine. Thank you both very much for all the information. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hey, look who named Christie is back from Iowa, where no one seems to know or care what a George Washington Bridge is. Stay with us.